Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 260, recorded for the week of May 15th, 2024. Amazon dispatches AWS CEO Adam Slipsky with Prime two-day delivery. Good evening, Matt, Jonathan, and Ryan.
Good evening.
Hey, Justin.
Hi there.
Yeah, hey, it's another fantastic week here in the cloud. A big news day, perhaps, between OpenAI yesterday, Google I.O. this morning, and a surprise resignation or termination or however you want to see it. It's a busy week in the news, so we should probably jump right into it so we can get to the good stories here. First up, Terraform Enterprise is adding Podman support and workflow enhancements to their product. Terraform Enterprise will support Podman with Red Hat Linux 8 and above. Originally only supported the Docker engine and cloud managed Kubernetes services like EKS or GKE. And with the upcoming end of life of Red Hat Linux 7 in June, customers face a lack of an end-to-end supporter option for running Terraform Enterprise on Red Hat Linux. And so Terraform fixed that issue by supporting Podman, which has now rectified the problem, which I'm a Podman fan personally. So very happy to see one more option for running containers.
I mean, this is for the small amount of customers running the enterprise, either on-prem or in their cloud environments. Pretty good option. Makes sense.
You would think they would have just pivoted to making sure Nomad was supported and pushed that a little bit more, too.
It'll come.
It'll come. The deal hasn't closed yet. You know, the thing I was most interested in about this actually is that Red Hat Linux 7 is now end of life, which this is my first time in my entire 20 some odd career that I've never had to support Red Hat Linux in production because we use Ubuntu for some weird reason. But which I actually appreciate because I always like Ubuntu best, but for my home projects. But I didn't actually know Red Hat 7 was going away. And I think isn't Red Hat 7 the last one that supports a lot of the legacy things that they killed to support CentOS and a bunch of things? So Red Hat 8 is now the default. That means that you are now out of luck unless you're going to Rocky Linux or something else for an open source Red Hat.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. It's a big change.
Yeah. I do really like Rocky Linux, though. I did play with that a bit. It feels very Red Hat-y still, or very CentOS, I guess, is really the right way to say it. But, you know, I appreciate that someone did that and they're not beholden to the Red Hat gods or IBM Red Hat gods as they are now.
You know, I didn't know anyone actually ran Podman for production workloads. I've always thought of it as a developer local tool rather than something you'd actually deploy, you know.
Yeah, because I feel like any of the real things that I actually launched, I use Podman locally, but then I launch in whatever container orchestration management tool, you know, I'm using at that point. So, yeah.
I mean, for really simple container workloads, you know, a lot of people have just instrumented Docker on a desktop or a server and then run, you know, the three or four containers they need because they don't need the overhead of Kubernetes. It's not a very common use case anymore because most people just get excited about Kubernetes. They're like, ooh, Kubernetes. There are those use cases out there where I just need a container or two. I don't need all the overhead, which, yeah, you're right. Nomad eventually would replace that, I assume. But I've never used Podman in production. I, like Matt, use it on my desktop and nowhere else.
You mean I should be running Kubernetes on my Synology downstairs?
You could do that. I do that. Actually, well, it's not on the Synology. The Synology is just a node in my Kubernetes cluster that runs on my Raspberry Pis, my stack of them. All right. OpenAI launched their newest version of GPT. GPT 4.0, or O for Omni, model, which can now reason across audio, vision, and text in real time. The new model can accept input combinations of text, audio, and images and generate any combination of those as output. It can respond to audio inputs as little as 232 milliseconds with an average of 320 milliseconds, very similar to the human response time in conversation. If you've ever seen the movie Her, this is the realization of Her. It matches GPT-4 Turbo performance on text and English and code, with significant improvements in text on non-English languages, while also being much faster and 50% cheaper in the API. GPT-4.0 is especially better at vision and audio, and previously you could interact with ChatGPT using voice mode, but the latency was 2.8 seconds for GPT-3.5 and 5.4 seconds for GPT-4 on average. And this is because the old model was three separate models put together, one that took your audio and converted to text, text then went to the GPT processing engine, and then the text was converted back to audio using a different model, and that was not great, as GPT-4 also lost things like tone, multiple speaker identification, or background noise in this translation, and can't output laughter, singing, or express emotion. ChatGPT wants to point out that they have also assessed the model with their preparedness framework and aligned with voluntary commitments, as well as extensive external red teaming with 70 plus external experts in domains such as social psychology, bias and fairness, and misinformation to identify risks that are introduced or amplified by the newly added modalities. They recognize that the audio modalities present a variety of novel risks, and they are publicly releasing text and image inputs and text outputs over the weeks and months while they work through the technical infrastructure usability via post-training and safety necessary to release the other modalities in a way that doesn't result in bomb threats. The new model is the latest step in pushing the boundaries of deep learning, this time in the direction of practical usability. It's been a lot of effort over the last 2 years working with efficiency improvements at every layer of the stack, and GPT-4o's capabilities will be rolled out iteratively with extended red team access. This will all be rolled out in ChatGPT right now for the text and imaging capability. And like I said, this will be available in the free tier and to plus users with 5x higher message limits. API access is available now for both text and vision models. And GPT-4o is 2x faster and half the price and has 5x higher rate limits compared to GPT-4 Turbo.
Did anybody else watch the presentation yesterday?
I watched the video samples they gave us, but I did not watch the full presentation.
It's amazingly impressive and also incredibly uncanny valley.
Yes, that was my takeaway from the examples they showed.
Yeah, especially the actually, it was interacting with a dog that kind of creeped me out the most. You see that one? It's like, oh, hi, buddy.
Mm-hmm. The dog was kind of like, what is happening right now?
Yeah.
It was interesting in the mobile app experience they're showing. It's like a black dot is the avatar for ChatGPT. I'm like, so it's just the black void of nothingness that's sucking us all down as we talk to it. It's great. Appreciate that.
I mean, I guess it could have been a red dot, but that would be a bit too much like Hal. So
yeah.
It's I don't know. Could we have imagined a year ago that something like this would have existed? I'm not sure if that was the case.
I mean, it's jumped leaps and bounds since you know, the first time it came on the market. I don't know about the 4.0 part. Like, I get the Omni idea, but I mean, it's just confusing. GPT-4 or GPT-4.0, which one are you using? It's not easy to identify. It's not easy to say. I can tell you, as I said it multiple times in that article, which is why the show title this week is Hi-Ho, Hi-Ho, GPT-4.0, because that's all I can hear when I see it.
Now, what are we going to use it for? I mean, call centers. Easy. I can imagine scammers would start using this kind of technology to make robocalls and scam people out of money, or maybe debt collectors.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many opportunities for it to be abused. And then also with voicing, you know, if you can start setting the voice to other people, and then next thing you know, your mother is calling you desperately in need of money and asking you to wire her money because she ended up in Tahiti. And you're like, how did you end up there? Like, don't answer. It's just, I came here with your father and I need money. You know, weird stories are going to come out of this technology for sure.
Yep. But you want one at home though, you know, on the kitchen counter to chat to like a person. I'm not
like her. I don't know.
Yeah.
Only if it's useful.
Only if it's useful.
I don't need the inane banter. I have kids for that.
But no, it could distract your kids. The kids could have inane banter with it, so they bother you less. That's how that
works. I like this.
All right. Well, we'll see what people use of this disaster to scare us with new new ways of violating GPT and chat AI that will scare us to death later in the podcast. So I appreciate that. Well, Amazon replaced their AI, I guess, this week with Adam Slipsky stepping down from his role as CEO of Amazon Web Services, and he is being replaced by Matt Garman. Adam was tapped 3 years ago by Andy Jassy as Andy transitioned to replace Jeff Bezos, of course. And prior to being CEO, Slipsky spent a decade running AWS sales, marketing, and support before leaving to run Tableau with their acquisition by Salesforce. Jassy wrote, "I'd like to thank Adam for everything he's done to lead AWS over the past 3 years. He took over during the pandemic, which represented a various leadership and business challenges. And under his direction, the team made the right long-term decisions to help customers become more efficient in spending, even if it meant less short-term revenue for AWS. Matt Garman has been with AWS for 18 years, starting as an intern in 2005 before leading several product divisions, including Amazon EC2 and AWS Compute Services. And he has recently served as SVP of AWS Sales, Marketing, and Global Services. Jassy says on Matt, Matt has an unusually strong set of skills and experiences for this new role. He's a very customer-focused, a terrific product leader, inventive, a clever problem solver, write a lot, has high standards, and a meaningful bias for action. And in 18 years spent at AWS, he's been one of the better learners I've encountered. So high praise from Mr. Jassy.
I wish executive, you know, letters were truthful and honest in some way. Like, because I, you know, on one hand, like, you know, I hope it is just a matter of Adam saying, you know, this job's hard and I only want to do it for a few years and move on. But I doubt it, just because it seems that it's all performance based and, you know, probably not getting along or not making enough meaningful movements in the right areas. And so
missing the mark on Gen AI, perhaps.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because in the, you know, in the letter, Adam Slipsky got the spending more time with family line, which is always a telltale of like, ooh, you didn't do so well. But also in like the Register article, they talked about the language, you know, Andy Jassy uses, was that this is always a temporary assignment.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Which I thought was really interesting because that's never been publicly disclosed. This is a temporary assignment. But, you know, there were the comment at the time when Andy stepped away to be the CEO was Matt Garman had been kind of always seen as a successor, but he is only a VP at the time. And he never ran sales, marketing, and global services. And so they brought in Adam and they quickly moved Matt over into running sales, marketing, and global services, which he's been doing for the last 3 years to basically get the experience. Like, I think they saw it was missing. But he also got the promotion to SVP at that time to then make the transition to CEO make more sense in general.
Yeah. I mean, I suspect it's always been the plan, but just timetable is probably the difference.
Yeah, maybe Bezos had planned to step down later than he did, and he left earlier, and that kind of put the timetable for succession in flux. I don't know. But yeah, it's interesting because Matt Garman's overseeing a pretty large reorganization of sales, marketing, and global services. That's not very popular with salespeople internally to Amazon, from what I've heard, and what people were talking about on Twitter and the other forums, or people were talking about this announcement today. But he was always really, really well respected as a technologist and a global leader. So if this moves us into more innovation beyond Gen AI, I'd be super excited. But I'm also worried that this is acknowledgement that Adam didn't do a good enough job with Gen AI, and now we need more Gen AI to be successful.
Yeah. I was impressed. He started as an intern. I think that's pretty sweet. And now he's...
There's still hope for you, Ryan, to be CEO.
Yeah.
Ugh. An intern in 2005 when the stock was $2 a share.
It's impressive. Nice. Growth. I mean, you definitely won't get any fresh blood, though, at that level. You know, people who've seen other companies and how they work. Although, I don't know that any company other than like IBM or Microsoft could compare to something the size of Amazon and being able to run any of those businesses.
Yeah, I always feel like when they say, you know, we'd like to thank Adam... We'd like to thank person for their blah, blah, blah. It's like, it sounds so disingenuous.
But, you know, it's funny because I was on, it hasn't dropped yet. It'll drop a time this episode's out. I was on Screaming with the Cloud with Corey. And, you know, we were talking about a bunch of different topics. And one of the ones that I brought up to talk with Corey about was, you know, how's Andy and Adam doing, you know, a couple of years into this transition? And, you know, we're kind of focused a little bit on Andy and his ability to run Amazon, and, you know, is he kind of a Steve Ballmer-esque person? But, you know, we talked about Adam as well, that he seems kind of like nothing's really happened in AWS in 3 years. And so we just had this conversation like a week and a half ago for the recording of that episode that drops this week. And I think Corey this morning, I was like, I swear I knew nothing, absolutely nothing about this. But yeah, it was just, you know, it's kind of interesting that, you know, and my thought about this morning was, well, if both Corey and I were kind of seeing similar things, you know, people internally were saying it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so this has probably been something in the making for a while. And again, it may have been temporary all along, which, again, was never publicly disclosed.
Didn't they take a lot of court? It's CEO replacement or, you know, to replace Jassy?
It was pretty quick.
I don't remember this being a temporary thing or even like having the trappings of a temporary thing. It just seems like more just BS they're feeding us.
Well, it may have been some temporary idea because Matt Garman wasn't ready, but you'd never tell the public that, because if you said that to the street, the street would crucify you on the stock. And number two, every question would be, he'd be a dead, you know, a dead lame duck president, basically, right, at that point, not being able to be successful. So even if it was an Andy Adam conversation that, you know, hey, I'm only willing to do it for 3 years, you would never talk about it outside of that group.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Charlie Bell was also kind of considered for it, wasn't he? I think there was discussion about that, and then he left shortly after.
Yeah, I mean, that was a fallout of him picking Adam. It was like he went to Microsoft instead. Mm.
3 years isn't really that temporary, I feel like. Temporary to me would be like a year, maybe 18 months.
Yeah, I don't buy the temporary part. Like, even though it was in the article, I'm like, I don't know.
It seems awfully suspect.
Everything's temporary. It just matters, you know, kind of what time scale they're thinking about.
Well, you know, it's tough times in the economy right now. And so I have outsourced this late news article to Jonathan, who promptly outsourced it to Amazon. And so the next story is brought to you by Amazon Polly. And enjoy.
Generative engine and three voices are now generally available on Amazon Polly. Today, we are announcing the general availability of the generative engine of Amazon Polly with three voices. Ruth and Matthew in American English, and Amy in British English. Standard TTS voices, introduced in 2016, use traditional concatenative synthesis. This method strings together the phonemes of recorded speech, producing very natural-sounding synthesized speech. However, the inevitable variations in speech and the techniques used to segment the waveforms limit the quality of speech. Neural TTS, NTTS, voices, introduced in 2019, use a sequence-to-sequence neural network that converts a sequence of phonemes into spectrograms and a neural vocoder that converts the spectrograms into a continuous audio signal. In February 2024, Amazon scientists introduced a new research TTS model called Big Adaptive Streamable TTS with Emergent Abilities, BASE. With this technology, the Amazon Polly generative engine is able to create human-like synthetically generated voices. Here are the new generative voices.
"What are you looking at?" he said as he stood over me. They got off the bus and started searching the baggage compartment. The tension on the bus was like a dark, menacing cloud that hovered above us.
The guards were standing outside with some of our neighbors listening to a transistor radio. "Any good news?" I asked. "No, we're listening to the names of people who were killed yesterday," Bruno replied.
Selma was lying on the ground halfway down the steps. "Selma! Selma!" we shouted in panic.
Wow. So I guess we're going to retire from the podcast and just let Polly do it from now on. Right. We have a British voice there. We can even get some diversity with some women voices involved. You know, we don't need any of us anymore. We'll just write it up and put it to Polly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, all I'm thinking is if Kindle doesn't have this as an option to read any book as an audiobook within 6 months, I will eat my hat.
Yeah. No. I mean, it already sounds, you know, like as someone who listens to a lot of audiobooks, it sounds like so many of the readers.
It's amazing, like every little intonation that it has, like the ups and the downs, like, you know, like when you read and you start like reading the next word, but before you say it, like you adjust your voice to like, "Oh my God, this happened." Like it picks that up too, which is fascinating and amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I guess consider that they probably use the entire catalog of Audible books to train this.
Yeah.
Touché.
Fair point. Yeah.
Fair point. Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's so that was written, you know, came from the Polly conversion of any of the Amazon articles. So other news articles have a Polly link you can basically play, I believe, right, Jonathan? So it's sort of interesting that they haven't updated that model yet to use the new base model, which would be kind of interesting to see when they do that. But I mean, just even when I was reading the article before the show and they had this audio samples, you can listen to the same audio of each of the new voices in both the TTS and the old legacy neural TTS. You can now compare them right there, the same paragraph. And it's amazing how improved that is. This is in this technology in general, but yeah. Audible, you know, ebook readers, probably not a lucrative career long term.
Yeah, it'd be so cool for so many things. Think about like the gaming industry now, and now you can have NPCs with generative AI sitting behind them and AI voices. It's just the possibilities are just amazing.
Yep. Well, you know, we had ChatGPT 4.0. We'll talk about some other models a little later, but Amazon has a model to share with us as well this week. The newest member of the Amazon Titan family of models, Amazon Titan Text Premier, which is now available to you in Bedrock. This follows the previous announcements of Titan Text Lite and Titan Text Express. The Premier is the latest in the significant language package. It has a maximum content length of 32,000 tokens. It's been specially optimized for enterprise use cases such as building RAG and agent-based applications with knowledge base and agents for Amazon Bedrock. Titan was pre-trained on multilingual text data, but is best suited for English language tasks. And you can further fine-tune with your own data in Bedrock to build applications that are specific to your domain, organization, brand style, and use cases. You can leverage Titan, Text Premier, and RAG use cases through the Amazon KB for Amazon Bedrock and automating tasks through integrations with agents for Amazon Bedrock. I mean, thanks, Amazon, for playing. I guess I see why Adam's no longer there, because the other guys just kicked the crap out of you. Although that Poly thing was pretty good, but yeah. You know, everything else, you know, small text LLMs are not very exciting right now.
I wonder, actually, because with the, you know, as the, just like everything, right? Edge computing, you know, AI is going to have to get smaller and more proficient in smaller areas. And so it's kind of a funny area to be in. We'll see.
Well, it's kind of like the evolution of a lot of things. It goes, you know, we build these things, they start small, we build them big, and then we go back to building them small, but far more efficient. And that's kind of, I feel like, the same trend we're going to see is like, you know, GPT-4 is built on X number of, you know, more than GPT-3, and GPT-5 is going to be on multiple X. And then at one point, we're going to be, okay, we have all this, but we want it. We can run it on the supercomputers in the world. Now, how do we take that and make it run on our cell phones? And then we'll start to see efficiencies with everything. And that will bring it back down to smaller, more digestible chunks for your cell phone, your laptop, things to run more ad hoc.
I mean, I need to do an upgrade a lot of my computer hardware, because I think my phone has more power than most of my computing devices these days.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think my headphones have more computing power than most things I have these days.
Yeah.
There's new iPads you can buy.
I looked. I was drooling over some of the specs. Yeah.
Yeah. They're pretty impressive. If the new iPad actually could run Mac OS, it'd be a badass laptop. But alas, we're stuck with iPad OS. All right. Amazon is previewing Amazon Bedrock Studio, a new web-based generative AI development experience. The Bedrock Studio accelerates the development of generative AI applications by providing a rapid prototyping environment with key Amazon Bedrock features, including knowledge base, agents, and guardrails. As a developer, you can build applications using a wide array of top-performing models and evaluate and share your generative AI apps with Bedrock Studio. The user interface guides you through various steps to help improve a model's response. You can quickly experiment with model settings and securely integrate your company's data sources, tools, and APIs, and set guardrails. You can collaborate with team members to ideate, experiment, and refine your generative AI applications, all without advanced ML expertise or AWS Management Console access. And all I can think about this is, it's a web version of LM Studio. So I appreciate that, AWS.
They've always tried to build these like web console studios for stuff, and I've never seen them fully take off, like Cloud9 and I thought they released another one later on of like these studio, these web portals that kind of act as your editors of sorts. And they all seem good, but I feel like most people I know never actually fully get all the way into them.
I agree with you on that, like their track record. But I will say that though, in the industry, I do think that this is an area where specifically having that sort of studio environment has really benefited. I think this is one of the reasons why Google is usually leading in a lot of these areas, because the Vertex AI sort of studio flow makes it really approachable and easy to play around and demo stuff. And so I think this is another area where they're playing a little catch up in Bedrock space. But yeah, there's companies, you know, like I think a lot of the, you know, even when it was still machine learning, you know, Databricks had a lot to do. It was a lot to do with the UI that they were given for running those machine learning jobs. And I think it is sort of where the, you know, it's the value of no code, but, you know, in application design, I think it's kind of fascinating.
I guess everyone's just really putting their own spin on Jupyter Notebooks. But
mm-hmm. it's a little bit better than a Jupyter Notebook.
I guess so. I customize for this particular use case, but
yeah, they have a couple other studios they've done too that I'm unsure of adoption or popularity yet, but it's good to see anything to make it, you know, be able to experiment quickly. It's sort of nice, so I appreciate it.
I've seen them used more by people when you're trying to access like private data. So like if you need access to SQL and you don't want to do a VPN or open it up to the world, like you need to start playing with things along those lines. That's where I've seen these kind of leveraged a little bit more, or like in more secure environments.
Yeah, you're seeing a lot of connectors, right? Like with popular tools. So easy ways to sort of feed a whole bunch of data into a model and you know, train a chatbot based off of that data. You know, integrations with popular cloud services, integrations with different database types, you know, and it's just an easy button sort of optimization for that. A lot of the studio is built around those types of things.
What does this Bedrock Studio thing cost? Does it say? I'm curious. Pricing. So, I don't see any mention of the studio in the pricing page. I wonder if you only pay for the model access, which if that's the case, that's actually even really nice because I was just looking at it. Like you set it up with a single sign-on provider like Google Workspace or Outlook or Microsoft Azure AD or Entra ID, and then you give access to it. So you don't even have to have access to AWS, you know, natively, which is pretty nice. So again, it's just one more way to get people into this AI craze without having to, you know, be a machine learning scientist.
Yes, there's no additional cost. I found their preview blog post. No additional cost. Customers only pay for usage, for example, API calls. And hosting of knowledge bases.
Well, guess what I'm going to do is hook this up to our Google workspaces for the Cloudpod, and then you guys can play with it.
So cool.
I will do that this weekend. And we can talk about it on the show. All right. Well, for, you know, the problem I have with Jonathan really is that he runs a lot of ML workloads that cost me a lot of money in my account. And the challenge with that is that I can only find out about it once a day. So by the time I find out about it, Jonathan's racked up at least a $5 bill. And that is just too much money that I don't want to spend. But now with the cost anomaly detection reduction in anomaly detection latency by up to 30%, I'll now know 30% faster than before. And that's because cost anomaly detection before only ran once a day, and now it runs 3 times a day. So I'm on top. I'll see it this afternoon, Jonathan. Don't leave that thing running.
Well, if you buy me that GPU I asked for, I wouldn't have to.
When we get our next sponsor, you can get the GPU.
Yeah. I have so many times I've added like a NVIDIA 4090, 24 gig of RAM to a shopping cart and then thought, no, I can't.
We'll need more solar panels to power
it. Because I don't want to. Yeah.
Well, if you can drink the Bitcoin out of it, then maybe that works out for you. Just, you know, keep buying more cards with Bitcoin. Well, RSA was last week, and the Register ended up snagging AWS Chief Information Security Office member Chris Betts to share some thoughts on AI. He said companies forget about security of the application in their rush to use generative AI, and there needs to be safeguards and other protections around advanced neural networks from training to inference to avoid them being exploited or used in unexpected and unwanted ways. He talks about it as an AI stack or as a cake with 3 layers. The bottom layer is the training environment. This is where the LLM is built. How do you make sure you are getting the right data, the data is protected, and that you're training the model correctly and that you have the model working the way that you want it to? The middle layer of the cake provides access to the tools needed to run and scale generative AI apps, and this ensures that you run the model in a protected way, especially as these models can get handed increasingly sensitive private data. Finally, the top layer is the application that uses the LLM. Betts points out that the first few layers are new and novel for customers, but the third is susceptible to standard security attacks like cross-site scripting, et cetera, et cetera. And I find this funny because this is from Amazon, who did release Q and at reInvent. And on the day they announced it, people found all kinds of proprietary AWS knowledge inside of Q. So apparently that also goes for Amazon engineers. Don't forget about the application security.
Yeah, that they can just browse Amazon.com and use the AI bot there to ask questions. And you can give it new system prompts and ask it all kinds of ask it to write code, all kinds of stuff. They may have killed that by now, but as of a couple of weeks ago, that was still a free way to use generative AI.
Yeah, it's a whole new world out there, and companies are racing for adoption, right? It's if you're behind, it feels really behind because of how fast everything's moving, and so you know it's a tricky thing because it's shortcutting security about it, but there's also sort of like we're having to figure out what the right way to secure development processes for AI are, right? Like, how do you train against, you know, exploiting at the prompt level? How do you segregate data access that's within the model training? And it's these are all new questions that we're sort of in the early days of figuring out, and we're having to do that while trying to reach into the market at record pace. And it's something bad is going to happen and reset this.
I mean, it's happened already. That's the problem. It's every day you can go find news.
You think it's been bad enough where it's actually caused so like security budgets to go up?
I mean, I'm sure it is, but not to the level that we are aware. I mean, so much bad code is generated by Copilot that people just accept blindly. I'm sure it's introducing security things. Just, we don't know yet. That's the problem. So I'm sure it's out there. I'm sure it's going to be attacked and exploited. And then people are going to go research and go like, where did this code come from? And they're like, oh, well, look, it was from this commit that happened to be from ChatGPT or from Copilot. So people will be fired, I'm sure.
So. You know, I think in the future, just as we have like labels on food, you know, GMO free or whatever, I absolutely think that there'll be an AI free label on products, and that being not driven by AI will be a marketing benefit to people. If you want to talk to Priyop, it used to be, oh, you know, we have American, you know, onshore call center staff. We don't farm work out to other places. Now it's going to be we have real humans to talk to. We don't use AI.
I saw that commercial yesterday. That already exists.
I mean, I looked at an air purifier because the world tries to kill me this time of year. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, the one that's not Wi-Fi enabled and says that it's AI, you know, whatever, it's run by AI is $5 more. I will buy that one. Because I don't really need my air purifier connected to the internet.
Dude, if I can't yell at my air purifier and have it turn on, I don't even know what living is anymore. I bought two Alexa enabled air purifiers, by the way. Like, that's nice. I did.
Nice.
Yeah. I have smart sockets in all of mine, so I can just do the same thing.
Yeah. Well, what I thought, we get a much bigger blog post from Jeff Barr talking about how this was discovered and how it was solved. Amazon has a very quick blog post saying that they are no longer charging for your S3 usage for unauthorized requests. So thanks. I was disappointed.
Yeah.
But it's now available as of May 13th. You will no longer get billed for any unauthorized access that is not from your own account.
Unless you're in GovCloud or China, because screw you.
Yeah, I've had the same disappointment that you did. Like, I thought this was a very interesting story in figuring out how to solve a problem like this, which is very complex, you know, because it's not something you can apply a blanket rule, and how would you, you know, sort of measure and detect this sort of scenario. And so I'm really hoping that there's a future more in-depth blog post about what they did.
I definitely think that once it's fully rolled out, they'll go into more details, because it does say in the article, you know, that it's going to be rolled out over the next few weeks, I think is what I saw. So I'm curious that like in a few weeks, if they're going to go into more detail on this.
Yeah, I'm hoping Jeff Barr will give us a blog post.
Do you know what's more old school than blowing on a Nintendo cartridge to make it work? Manually creating individual policies to achieve least privilege in your cloud. Leave old habits in the past, and with a single click, lock down access to sensitive permissions and services without disrupting DevOps. With the new Cloud Permissions Firewall from Sunry Security, you can easily restrict excessive permissions from human and machine identities, quarantine unused identities, and restrict specific regions and unused services with a click of a button. Start a 14-day free trial for Sunry's Cloud Permissions Firewall at sunry.co/cloudpod. That's sonrai.co/cloudpod.
All All right, Amazon is releasing the new C7i Flex instances, which are great for workloads that don't require full compute power 100% of the time. This was first announced with the M7i Flex last August, and that's been a good success with their customers and resonated well. And so the expansion of the C7i makes the most sense. The C7i is available in a 2x4 configuration or 2 CPU at 4 gigs of memory, up to 32 CPU and a 64 gigabytes of memory configuration. This is perfect for sporadic workloads computing needs. The C7i Flex is a great choice, but it's not good for high compute processing, multiplayer gaming, or video encoding use cases that require high continuous CPU load. The C7i comes in additional shapes versus the Flex if you want more options or bare metal. And the C7i also comes with higher bandwidth and storage guarantees for how you use it. So if you're thinking between the C7i and the Flex, I'm thinking like web servers, very sporadic traffic, this is not a bad use case, a good price balance as long as you can fit inside the shape. But if you need guaranteed performance when you need it at the level you expect, move into the C7i family of configurations at a much bigger size, or even at these configurations as well. So this is sort of like the evolution of the T and the guaranteed burst capacity of the T series, but in a slightly different way.
Yeah, do they still have like the sort of CPU credit model where like...
Yeah, so that's the T. They don't have it on the C7s, but they do on the T still. But you know, on the T side, even they got rid of the guaranteed CPU time, but you could basically click a box and you wouldn't get burst credits anymore.
On the T3s, yeah.
Yeah, on the T3s. So this is kind of like a next evolution of it where, you know, it's a workload that is more sporadic and you don't need guaranteed throughput or capacity, but you do want it when you need it for short bursts.
I've actually read this article.
Wow.
I looked into it more because I was kind of confused, like what the difference between Flex and Burstful really was. And so Flex gives you a 40% baseline all the time, and you can scale up to full CPU for 95% of the time in a 24-hour period. And so you don't have the same, you know, you don't build credits like you do with a Burstful.
Yep. So again, it's not a bad use case. There's not a really good way to monitor it. Like, how often are you going over that 40% usage timeline? Those have been, it's not in the CloudWatch that I saw, and at least the metric that they're tracking. So I expect that maybe we'll see some improvements to this over time if more adoption happens and they run into limitations or scale. But other side, just one more way to sell capacity at a cheaper price that makes customers happy.
I think people will find the limits the same way they find them on the T series, like, you know, like 25 minutes after you're trying to figure out why your app has just started sucking all of a sudden.
Yeah, well, your app is dead.
Yeah. I think that's why they made Flex, though, because I think everyone went for the burstful instances, and then they made them so that you could automatically scale up anyway and just pay for the extra capacity at any time. So that basically is Flex, but without having to hassle with the CPU credits.
Wasn't that by default enabled, I thought, in like T4s or T3s, where like it just...
It gets the default enabled in a later... Yeah, I think it's in the T4, where they just check the box by default. You have to uncheck it.
I just also assumed that was because they were sick of support cases around the same things.
Probably, yeah. But yeah, it's sort of interesting. They tried a couple things on this. Remember, they had RIs for like low utilization versus high utilization compute instances and things. So they've tried all kinds of different tricks to kind of give you options around, you know, the idea of a computer that doesn't need all the CPU all the time, but when you do need it, it needs it right then.
I'm still kind of unsure, like, what it means, because these CPUs scale their clock frequencies. So is 40% of the maximum speed, or is it 40% of the cores, or is it like, what does that mean exactly?
40% of Amazon magic.
Yes.
Amazon magic. That's the best way to describe it.
Yep.
Well, let's move on to GCP. First up, Active Assist, which is in the UI, has a new hub version and 4 new recommendations for you this week. Intelligent tools from Active Assist help you do things like reduce costs, increase performance, improve security, and even help you make sustainable decisions. These new Active Assist features will help address even more of your largest concerns. First up, the revamped recommendation hub gives you a new organizational view of all your projects' recommendations in one UI versus the previous method, which required you to click on every one of your projects, which sucks when you have thousands of them. Pre-filtered recommendations by value category, so you can now view all of your recommendations under one category in a simple table view, so you can prioritize and focus on recommendations that are the most relevant and important to you, as well as custom sorting and filtering within their table views, so you can sort and filter by different fields. I really like the fact they wrote a blog post about a grid view and described all the benefits of a grid view. Makes me laugh. The new recommendations that are also coming to you this time is a new cloud deprecation and breaking changes recommendations. Since this is Google, that will get a lot of use because everything gets broken and deprecated at Google. Nice. You get IAM for BigQuery recommendations. You get advisory notification recommendations as well as recent change recommendations to help you find what's changed in your infrastructure. So these are nice little enhancements.
That change is a nice little touch. I like that one. It's I like this optimization overall. I laugh at, you know, anything that's optimization because it's like a great way to build a report that no one's going to read or act on. But you still have to do it because otherwise you'll get no traction. But some of the other optimizations and insights that they're building into this experience, I think, will be really powerful for cloud providers and practitioners. So pretty cool.
Yeah, the deprecation is nice because I swear I just get, you know, an email per subscription that we have every time Amazon or Azure says, oh, we're deprecating this thing, and or hey, we have this breaking change. And it's just like email bursts versus, you know, a slightly more centralized view to be able to see everything in one place. So this is where I feel like I'm slowly losing my technical touch because I'm like, ooh, a single place to see where they're breaking everything.
Well, in the case of Google, sorry, in Azure case, they have a tendency to do like, they have Patch Tuesday where they give it patches. They have Deprecation Monday where like they just deprecate like 100 things in one day. Like the Azure way is kind of terrible too.
I mean, you could go the AWS way of we don't really deprecate until we just turn it off and see who yells.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I think they've been sending me emails about my outdated MySQL Aurora database for like a good year and a half now.
Oh, on the SSL certificates or on the actual version of MySQL?
I don't know. I don't read those emails either.
Oh, okay.
He has to figure out a password to get into it.
Yeah. It's in my personal account. Like, I don't care.
Kubernetes 1.3 is now available in GKE Rapid Release Channel. Less than 20 days after the OSS release, and you see Amazon crying over there in the corner because they only dream of that kind of speed. 1.3 has several enhancements, including validating emission policy, which allows many emission webhooks to be replaced with policies defined using the Common Expression Language and evaluated directly by the Kube API server. This feature benefits extensions, authors, and cluster administrators by dramatically simplifying the development and operation of emission extensions. Validation ratcheting, which makes custom resource emissions even safer and more simple to manage, and aggregated discovery graduates to general availability, improving clients' performance, particularly kubectl, when fetching the API information needed for many common operations. So Kube 1.30 now available to you in the rapid release channel of GKE. 20 days after it was released. Oh. It does help that Google probably wrote most of it.
Right.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like they should have it in the rapid release channel like the day that it's released, but maybe it's a little overkill. They know it's coming, they're writing it.
Well, I mean, if you think about orchestrating that at scale, right? So rapid release 20 days after the version, they've already gone through all of that, you know, how to offer Kubernetes as a service, scaling and management. It's pretty crazy.
What's how long does it take them to go from rapid release to stable normally though?
It's normally over a couple months, I think. Okay. And then like you have always a progression of features that are, you know, early access and then general available. So they always have kind of a rolling cadence to them. Unfortunately, Google I/O started today, and so now I have to tell you about, you guessed it, AI stuff from Google.
Oh God.
First up is the new announcement of the Trillium TPU, which has achieved a 4.7 time increase in peak compute performance per chip compared to the TPU V5e, which didn't they just announce that at Next? It was not that long ago. They
doubled like yesterday.
They doubled the high bandwidth memory capacity and bandwidth and also doubled the interchip interconnect bandwidth over the TPU V5e, as well as Trillium is equipped with third generation sparse core, specialized accelerator for processing ultra-large embeddings, common in advanced ranking and recommendation workloads. Trillium can scale up to 256 TPUs in a single high bandwidth, low latency pod. That's an expensive set of infrastructure.
I wonder, like past benchmarking, like are people really looking at these numbers? Because it just sounds like made up terms and words to me now.
I mean, I'm sure someone cares who's building really large models like Cohere or OpenAI, or, you know, people who build models probably care about these because like every second you know, you save, at the scale they're trying to build these models in, you know, can result in days of savings in building a new model.
I still remember being like, oh, we're going to use a placement group to save those couple of milliseconds on CPU. And now it's just laughable, even thinking about that difference here.
Oh, yeah, placement groups or like rack, basically, yeah. Like rack planning. Yeah.
Well, you had placement groups. And then at one point, I was studying for one of the exams on AWS, and it was, there was actually multiple kinds of placement groups at that point, which I did not know existed. So I was studying for an exam.
Those placement groups are always weird. They were really for HPC workloads at the time, wasn't it? Was the purpose of those?
Yeah, it was a healthcare company that was doing like DNA sequencing or something like that, that we helped do it. And we used to take down US West 1, take up all spot capacity every time we would run their workload at night.
Ryan mentioned rack planning, which reminds me of a story. We had this data center we were building out, and you know, like five racks, and the person, you know, built it out and laid the whole thing out. So, you know, we had the least amount of distance between for the copper to some connectivity thing. And then, you know, my dumb ass, I'm just there. I plug everything with the longest cable. Screw the rack plan. All the like, why am I getting what I said? Oh, cause I used that 25-foot cable. Sorry. Yeah. Let me go swap that out for you. Yeah. Good times. Well, Vertex AI, of course, has some big updates, and since this is a developer conference, Vertex AI is the place to have those updates. Those updates include new models from Google DeepMind, which is available today. The Gemini 1.5 Flash model in public preview offers their groundbreaking context window of 1 million tokens, but it's lighter weight than 1.5 Pro and designed to efficiently serve with speed and scale for tasks like chat apps. Pali Gemma, available in the Vertex AI Model Garden, is the first vision-first language model in the Gemma family of open models and is well-suited for tasks like image captioning and visual question answering. They have three models that are coming very soon. Imagen 3, is their high-quality text-to-image generation model. Gemma 2 is the next gen of open models built for a broad range of AI use cases. And Gemini 1.5 Pro with expanded 2 million context window is coming very soon. In the Vertex AI solution itself, it gets three new capabilities: context caching, which lets customers actively manage and reuse cached context data; control generation, which lets customers define Gemini model outputs according to specific formats or schemas; and finally, a batch API, available in preview, is a super efficient way to send large numbers of non-latency sensitive text prompt requests supporting use cases such as classification and sentiment analysis, data extraction, and description generation. Agent Builder was first announced at Next24, has some new enhancements like support for Firebase GenKit and Llama Index on Vertex AI. And GenKit, announced by the Firebase today, is an open source TypeScript JavaScript framework designed to simplify the development, deployment, and monitoring of production-ready AI agents. Ooh, that's a lot.
Yeah, I think of all of this, a lot of the batch API stuff seems pretty interesting to me. You know, being able to just fire it, and you know, I'm waiting to see like a spot market for LLMs almost of like, hey, no one's using it, let me go run my sentiment analysis of, you know, everything that happened overnight type of thing, or really being able to more cost effectively run it, you know, where you have like real time queues and low priority and medium priority queues, you know, and low priority will run, you know, at any given time. And that's where I feel like this batch API can start to eventually turn into. So that seems like a really cool feature.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, if you think about, you know, summarization requests or you know, captioning of videos where it doesn't have to be like on demand, doesn't have to be an active prompt that's two-way communication, like it's super powerful for things like that. Then you can just kind of store that result as metadata. So it's really powerful when designing AI integration into your app. It's pretty neat. I like the context too, just because I don't know how many times, like when I'm using AI, that I ask something and then I tweak it like a little bit.
Every time. Yeah. But it's just me.
And so I'm not, you know, familiar with the details of what they get to cache for context, but probably a fair amount.
You know, Imagen 3 reminded me of something about ChatGPT 4.0. So one of the things that annoys me the most about taking text and generating images is that if you give it text, it never produces the text correctly.
Text so and like, fingers.
Yeah, like it'll like, you're like, hey, I want you to draw me a Sherpa climbing Mount Everest, and below it, I want you to write the word Cloud Sherpa, right? Because you're trying to make a sticker or something. Yeah. And it'll be like Clud Sherpa, even though you spelled it exactly right, what you wanted, it is never correct. So in the new ChatGPT 4.0, one of the demos they showed you was actually where you gave it text input to have it generate into the image, and it actually uses the proper text. It doesn't modify it or change anything. So if Imogen 3 doesn't have that, I'm going to be super annoyed. But that just reminded me, though, that was one of the that's probably the number one feature from GPT 4.0 I'm excited about, is that I can now actually give it text to put into my logos it generates for me that is correct. Yeah. Versus its weird interpretation of it.
You can do that Claude too, actually. You can paste documents in, and it actually attaches it as an attachment, so you can attach an image or a document or anything else, and then ask it to do stuff.
Nice. I haven't tried it in Claude because it's not the one I think of when I go generate images. But maybe I'll try that.
I don't think it generates images, but it's very good at writing descriptions of images that you can then take someplace else.
Got it. Yeah, but the problem we were talking
about...
This
is more graphics than anything else. Like, yeah, it tries to produce a graphic that's not a word, but it's supposed to be a word.
Yeah, so like you'll say, like, generate this image for me and then add this text to it, and then it just munges the text to no end.
They all suck.
Yeah, so, but that was one of the things I was saying with GPT 4.0. They fixed that problem. So that's one of the demos they showed, is actually where you gave it text to put into the image, and it used the proper text. It didn't change it.
I may have to use that for our... AI is how ML makes money sticker thing, because I tried so hard to get an image generated, but the text never comes out right. And I really want the text to fit the style of what I'm trying to create.
Yeah, so you don't want to do it outside of it. Yeah, so GPT 4.0 should be able to do it. So maybe we'll finally get a sticker for our
well, long. I will. I'll give it a go.
Yeah. All right, moving on to Azure. First up, they're bringing AI to everyone's favorite pastime: network security. So both the Azure Web App Firewall and Firewall Integrations in Microsoft Copilot for Security standalone experience is now available. This is the first step towards bringing interactive generative AI-powered capabilities to Azure networking security. Organizations can empower their analysts to triage and investigate hyperscale data sets seamlessly to find detailed, actionable insights and solutions at machine speeds using a natural language interface with no additional training. Now, I'd like to pause here for a second, because when you read this article... And they talk about generating and working through thousands and thousands of log files. I'm like, really? Are you just giving me an Elasticsearch use case? But adding AI to it, I call shenanigans. But basically, Copilot automates manual tasks to help upskill tier 1 and tier 2 analysts to perform tasks that would otherwise be reserved for more experienced tier 3 and 4 professionals, which apparently search and logs is that level. Today, WAF detects a variety of web applications and API security tasks, generating terabytes of logs that are ingested into log analytics. The logs give insights into the WAF. It's non-trivial and time-consuming activity for analysts to understand the logs and gain actual insights. Copilot helps analysts perform analysis of data in minutes. Specifically, it synthesizes data from Azure Diagnostic Logs, generates summarization of Azure WAF rules triggered, investigation of security threats, including WAF rules triggered, malicious IP addresses, and analyzing SQL injection and cross-site scripting attacks blocked by the WAF. Which, if the WAF blocked it, I don't know that I care.
Oh, you do. Trust me, you do.
You do.
Azure Firewall has similar use cases, with analysts needing to look through large amounts of log, allow and deny logs, adding metadata about the IP, including IPs, sources, destination, and vulnerabilities, and CVEs associated with its signatures, is now made easy with Copilot for Security.
So this is my favorite thing about AI, is that all these domain-specific languages, these very custom, you know, query this and that, you know, where you're having to draft these complex, it feels like the 1990s, they tried to put computer hacking into a video game sequences, where it just gobbledygook and you're just trying to get it to, like, just show me all the traffic that came from this and where it went from here. Now being able to ask that in natural language and much more straightforward things is going to be really nice. And I can see why this is a big focus, because it's one of those things, like, if the WAF is blocking it, great, if it's a valid block. But you're always trying to find the one that's not valid. Like, why, or prove that it's not the WAF, right? Like, because someone's just complaining it's broken, and they're sure it's the WAF, but it's not.
It's good to know the WAF blocked, so that you can justify the expense.
While you're paying for it?
Yeah, sure. I guess so. But I mean, if we reread this article, you know, upskill tier 1 and tier 2 analysts, well, you know, they need to be upskilled, because if they don't, they're going to get replaced. And very shortly afterwards, the tier 3 and 4 professionals will also be replaced, because there's no reason a person needs to look at these logs to gather insights.
So that was on a couple of the calls I've been on with Microsoft. That's one of the big things they're pushing is Copilot helps all your tier one and tier two people really get, you know, solve all the problems that your tier three and four, you know, and that's one of the things that they're pushing is, hey, this is something that will actually like help your tier ones get done more of the work. And that's where they're stating that Copilot will actually help everything. Also, have you ever met a junior developer or really a senior developer that actually looks at logs? So like, yeah, sometimes you just have to tell people to look at logs.
Mm-hmm.
It's true.
I need you to look at the logs. But why? Because I need you to.
Oh, that error there. Read that. What's that error code say? Variable not found. Maybe that's your problem. No? Okay, cool.
I mean, there's a large amount of money that I would pay if Wireshark would come out with AI deep packet like readers. Because I swear to God, every time I try to use that program, which comes up way too often.
It has been a dream of mine for a long time that Wireshark will get more smarts. It's yeah. Just like, why don't you look at this stream of packets and tell me what the fuck's wrong?
Right.
Please.
It's cool that it's in color now. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Show me what I need to know or like the general area of like this 5-minute capture. Yeah. Not useful.
Actually, just to write the syntax to properly filter the data set to something reasonable may also be helpful.
Yeah. Just that.
Yeah. I normally just outsource that to somebody smarter than me and said, you deal with this.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's me.
Hey. Who do you think I call when I need help with network packet tracing?
Oh, God. I don't know what I'm doing.
Not often do I get to outsource to Ryan, but sometimes I do.
Actually, no, I spent a lot of time with Wireshark earlier in my career, so I still actually hop into a lot of Wireshark packet traces and can figure out the problem pretty quickly in a lot of them. But unless you get into like some of the complicated TLS handshake stuff, then I'm like, I don't really know that part anymore. But yeah. Basic like wire syntax problems, I can figure out pretty quick.
I think Go Look at Logs is like the new Go Pound Sand. That's a show title right there.
Yeah, that's a show title. Let's move back on to the next AI announcement from Azure. And that is that GPT-4 Turbo with Vision is now available on Azure OpenAI services with processes both text and image inputs and replaces several preview models. Customers in various industries have helped already use this multimodal model to enhance efficiency and innovate. The case studies to be featured at the upcoming Build conference, which we will not talk about. Those use cases. We'll talk about Build. But. And since I already spilled the news, Microsoft Spiller announced that launch of GPT-4o OpenAI new flagship model is available in Azure AI in preview.
Hooray!
You're welcome.
Yeah. I'm more surprised it took this long to get Turbo included in the name of these things. That's impressive.
It was in preview for a while. And then if you really look at this, Turbo is really available, I think, in like Sweden and East 2 and like maybe one other region with very limited quantities.
Yeah.
So
specific customer developed feature.
Gotcha. That's one of the things about AWS. A lot of the stuff is only available in East. There was something I was looking at. And I was like, I want to go check that out. And I logged into Amazon console and I'm in Oregon, which is where I have the CloudPod website. And it's like, yeah, that doesn't exist here. And I'm like,
yeah. So yeah, when you don't get it in Oregon, it's really like,
yeah,
crestfallen. Like, I get it if I'm in like a smaller region.
Yeah, if I'm in Northern California, I know I don't get anything there.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
All right. Next up is the Microsoft and LinkedIn are releasing the 2024 Work Trend Index, focusing on AI, of course, at work. This is the fourth annual Work Trend Index and the first time they partnered with LinkedIn in the joint report because there was a marketing reason too. They surveyed 31,000 people across 31 countries, identified labor and hiring trends from LinkedIn, analyzed trillions of Microsoft 365 productivity signals, and did research with Fortune 500 companies. And they found this. Employees want AI at work. Shocker. And won't wait for companies to catch up.
No way.
Yeah. Per the company, 3 out of 4 knowledge workers now use AI at work. Employees overwhelmed and under duress say AI saves time, boosts creativity, and allows them to focus on important work. If 3 out of 4 knowledge workers are using AI right now, that's 3 out of 4 people who are using Shadow AI.
Oh, yeah.
Because most companies are still struggling with just the, even the idea of trying to use it for their corporate work. According to this, for employees, AI raises the bar and breaks the career ceiling for them. That's just wishful thinking.
Doubtful. Yeah.
And the rise of AI power users and what they revealed about the future will be a big portion of the future of work. And they're saying the prompt box is the new blank page. I'm like, ugh, this is gross. Thanks, LinkedIn.
Empty PowerPoint slide deck.
Although Power BI can do some pretty cool stuff with PowerPoint.
No, I mean, there's no doubt that it's useful, and there's a whole bunch of really mundane things that this is going to get rid of. And I'm pretty stoked about that, right? Like, I'm not too jazzed about, you know, everyone who's an entry-level position being sort of wiped out, and, you know, the still don't know what to do about, like, you know, if you don't have any entry-level positions, how do you get to the next level? But, you know, at a certain point, like, these things are, you know, like every automation enhancement, they replace a very fundamental part that's easy to recreate and saves a lot of time. And so, like, I think it's great. But yeah, shadow AI is going to be a big problem for a long time to come, just because there's a whole lot of legal ground that has to be developed to even know how to handle this.
100%. Well, Microsoft is introducing public preview of Azure Application Gateway V2 Basic SKU, which Matt kindly translated to me earlier is, it's a cheap load balancer. Enhanced features promising improved performance, scalability, and cost effectiveness in this new load balancer, but it has many features that are missing because it is the basic SKU. So if you want URL rewrite, pound sand. If you want MTLS, look at the logs. Can't get it. Private link, dead. Private only, dead. TCP and TLS proxying, not going to happen. But if you don't need those critical features, this is the solution for you.
Also at like a 90% savings, 24 cents an hour versus 2.7 cents per hour.
Couldn't you get an instance for that though? A VM and just build your own?
Yes, you could, Jonathan, but that's the engineer in you speaking, not the Azure admins.
Yeah. Hi. Well, write my own routing layer? What? No. Nginx rewrite? Ugh. Can't be bothered.
But there's a lot of like really simple workloads, you know, that I don't know how many times I've been like, oh, there's two web servers and I'm literally just passing all traffic through the, you know, ELB or ALB directly to two nodes and I'm calling it a day. Well, before at 20 whatever cents an hour, it's like $150 a month for a simple load balancer. You know, and like it was ridiculous that sum of money for such a simple service where I'm used to it being what, $16, $18 a month? On AWS, moving over. Yeah. What's up?
You're absolutely right. I mean, the majority of workloads I've set up, this would cover, right? Like it's,
yeah.
You know, sometimes you get like an extra enhancement that's a little bit gravy in some of these things. Like, you know, when you stopped having to manage TLS certificates, so you just terminated the load balancer, you know, that was one, that was just an enhancement, you know, but I could have very easily put a certificate on this on the server, right? That kind of thing. And so it's like, yeah, no, being able to make that trade-off and that choice, fantastic.
I mean, there's definitely a lot of places I will look at using this, just all these small, tiny workloads that don't need much. But before I was always sitting here going, well, what do we do with this thing, right? It's too expensive to run a, you know, this tiny web service behind this load balancer is going to cost me more than running the whole service. So I'm doubling the cost of the service just mm-hmm. to even run this versus, okay, cool. This will be here and I don't need URL rewriting or MTLS and it's a public service. Interesting that you can't do private only with it. I don't really technically know why, but you know, Microsoft charges for security and people just accept that in life, which is mind boggling to me still, but
you know, yeah,
I'm looking forward to using this.
I mean, but and complexity and cost at the routing layer, like, is why you have things like traffic and weird different things where you're routing traffic between pods and services in Kubernetes, right? Because internal load balancers were expensive and cumbersome.
I mean, what's if it's such a simple use case, why not just use round robin DNS? Does Azure yeah. have a similar, you know, Route 53 type health check for like dynamic?
But I don't want to put my servers public facing.
You want everything, don't you, Matt? Just
I just want a $16 a month application gateway on Azure. Maybe that's too much.
Need an outbound NAT, so he'll pay $250 a day for that.
I mean, I think it's like $250 for the standard SKU for App Gateway. There's no V1 anymore. V1, I think they've killed off and replaced V2. So it's really just, this is their new service. So really, it's now their basic, standard, and WAF enabled. And WAF is free if you have the DDoS protection at the global level. So, but between standard and this, it's an 80% cost savings for a really tiny workload. You're going from 250 down to, oh, someone's going to make me do math right now. Should have used real numbers.
No one here is going to make you do math.
You know, $50 a month. Like, that's a big cost difference. And it can, you can still tie skill sets to it or spot instances or anything else to it. So, yeah, I can't run MTLS, but maybe I don't need MTLS. Maybe the simple, you know, Atlanta server or whatever doesn't need it.
I feel like no one really needs mutual TLS. It's just something someone created because they're super anal about it. Yes. But well, just me. All right, moving on to Oracle. Apparently, customers are excited about the about the announcement from CloudWorld 2023 that Red Hat OpenShift was coming to OCI. And I'm pleased to tell you now that it's officially here. Red Hat OpenShift versions 4.14 and 4.15 are now validated on OCI's compute VMs. Like Red Hat Linux, they are working on validating bare metal shapes as a fast follow to the initial support for OpenShift. The following editions are available, including Platform Plus, Container Platform, and OpenShift Kubernetes Engine, which OpenShift Kubernetes Engine just seems silly because isn't OpenShift on top of Kubernetes already? Like,
yeah.
It's interesting.
What a strange announcement. Because it's not quite a managed OpenShift service. It's just, we've proven
we can run
it on there.
Yeah. it's like cool. How you do VMware on Oracle too.
Do you think by validated to run, they actually mean we negotiated the cut of the license fee?
It's just such a weird, like. Yeah, like, I read this thinking like, oh, cool, they're getting into managed services. They're doing all these. No, they're just straight compute. Like, you can run your stuff on this. Like, yeah. I probably could.
Probably could do it before. You just were going to tell me it maybe isn't supported.
Yeah.
If you catch me.
That's a weird division of responsibilities, though. It's like, I thought by the time we got to the VM layer, it's the customer's responsibility. So right? why would they care that it's validated or not? Know. Because, it just seems like a press release for the sake of a press release.
Oracle's not really a cloud, guys. Like, you should know this by now. It's apparently Elon doesn't care because Elon Musk and Oracle, which does seem like a match made in evil genius heaven, is apparently in negotiations for XAI to use OCI to train all of their models that they're working on. It'll cost $10 billion to run the cloud service from the company over a period of several years. And this is reported by The Information. The deal would make XAI one of Oracle's largest customers. And this is still a rumor as the negotiations are ongoing and not concluded yet. But this seems par for the course. Elon and Oracle on a deal, $10 billion. Done.
Wasn't there a news article where Elon like picked up a bunch of servers from AWS and like just like P2V'd them all back to on-prem and then like drove them from one data center to the other or something like that?
Yeah, that was Twitter, I think.
Yeah. So it feels like, why would he want to run it on the cloud if he thinks data centers?
Because he can't buy the
GPUs. He can't get the GPUs.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, he needs the GPUs. That's the problem.
And he's friends with Larry, so you know he's probably kind of a deal. Nobody else is using them.
No. Or here's how Oracle makes their money. They've been renting them to Azure, which is why they connected these things together, so Azure could get access to more GPUs. So now, all of a sudden, if Oracle has a prime customer who's going to pay them directly, they can cut Azure out of the deal. It's a win-win for Oracle. It's evil genius thinking here. Well, on that happy news of world domination from the XAI, that's it for the Cloud Pod this week, and it was a loaded show for sure. Lots of topics.
All right, I'll see you later, guys.
See ya.
Bye, everyone.
And that's the Week in Cloud. We'd like to thank this week's sponsor, Sunry. Check out a 14-day free trial at sunry.co/cloudpod. Check out our website, the home of the Cloud Pod, where you can check out our newsletter, Slack team, send feedback, or ask questions at thecloudpod.net, or tweet at us with #poundthecloudpod. I'm excited to finally talk about something that I saw over a year and a half ago as our after show topic. So Google is announcing that they are bringing Project Starline out of the lab and partnering with HP to basically build it. Project Starline is a breakthrough technology project that enables friends, families, and coworkers to feel like they're together from any distance. Using advancements in AI, 3D imaging, and other technologies, Starline works like a magic window. You can talk, gesture, and make eye contact with another person, just as if you were in the same room. Google is finally bringing the technology out of the lab with a focus on connecting distributed teams and individuals in the workplace, where they're partnering with HP to start commercialization of this unique experience in 2025, and are working to enable it directly from the video conferencing services you use today, such as Google Meet and Zoom, which opening it up to Zoom or to Teams or anything else is a dumb move by Google, because this technology is awesome.
I saw a video of somebody using it a while ago, but of course you lose any kind of feeling of what it's actually like to be using it. So
yeah. They've had this thing at Google Next. So if you've been an executive, you had a chance to probably get a chance to see it, but I actually saw it at Google headquarters. But you know, it's basically like a phone booth type setup. You know, there's cameras and stuff in front of you, and there's a screen basically right in front of you. It's a curved 3D screen, so you don't have to wear glasses, but basically the person is sitting, literally looks like they're sitting across from you in 3D. You know, eye contact, like, you know, another way, a webcam, like right now I'm talking to you guys, but I'm looking at my computer, so you're seeing my eyelids when we're talking. None of that happens because the AI and basically all this stuff built into Starline basically make sure that we have solid eye contact. And so it literally feels like you could reach out and touch the person where you're there, which is probably one of the coolest, most Star Trek-y demos I've seen of technology in a long time. This thing coming out in 2025 is going to potentially be a great product unless HP screws it up, which is an if. you know, I'm just glad this thing's finally coming to reality, because I was hoping it would come out a while ago. But very cool. It's very low latency too, and the bandwidth requirements was one of the concerns I had. I was like, well, what, you know, because there's this Cisco telepresence solution that requires like dedicated ISDN lines to make it work.
I remember that.
Yeah, and a whole bunch of very specialized equipment. Yeah.
And so this isn't, you know, this is going to have some type of specialized camera equipment, and of course the TV and some parts of it that you had to buy. But it can scale the bandwidth needs, from lower latency 256K like type circuits all the way up to, you know, massive throughput, you know, pipes that Google has. So it's designed to be able to scale up and down. And of course, it was started in the pandemic for good reasons, with the idea that maybe this would be something to sell for home. But it's probably too expensive in the initial iterations. But this is something that, you know, 10 years from now, if this thing takes off, it could be huge.
Do you think it'll sell for less than a Vision Pro?
I don't know. it definitely takes a lot of cameras. It definitely has a lot of tracking, and there's a lot of compute power. But I do assume that you could use the cloud to help augment some of that if the latency is low enough. So, you know, $3,000, maybe. Yeah. Seems maybe reasonable.
Yeah, cameras are cheap. Compute's cheap. It's the screen that's going to be the expensive bit, I guess.
Yeah, that stereoscopic 3D screen. Yeah,
yeah. It's
going to be pricey.
I mean, the Nintendo 3DS was an interesting experience, but scaling that up to the size of a 21-inch monitor or something is
a bit impossible. Yeah,
yeah, that's cool. You know, I was just thinking at the end of the show how interesting it would be to have like Elon Musk as the bad guy in the next Bond movie.
Yeah, but the thing is, he would do it as a cameo and not know that they were parroting him or making fun of him.
Well, I'm excited to see that. Be cool.
Yeah,
cool to go and take a look at it.
Definitely worth checking out if you get a chance to ever go to a Starline demo. I highly recommend it because it's one of the coolest tech things I've seen in a while. Yeah, I haven't tried the Vision Pro, because I don't have $3,400 to throw at that. But I'm going to an Apple store is a bit of a hike, so to, you know, play with one in an Apple store is not something I've done lately. But I hear that's a pretty good technology too. But you know, my kids have Quest 2s or Quest 3s, that thing is fine. I don't know why I need better than that.
Yeah, I would not be surprised if Apple just kills it in a year or so.
Apparently it's pretty got a lot of popularity in the enterprise, so if they can sell a few to keep the, you know, to keep it going and then lower the price, they'll be fine. But right now the concern I have is content and app support for it doesn't really exist.
Why the enterprise for that feels
manufacturing? like augmented reality type
surgery, yeah. All kinds of stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, if businesses are perfectly fine paying $3,500 for a laptop, then I guess a headset that costs the same isn't too much of a stretch. But I guess, you know, the developers though who work on this stuff, they should get a discount or something to help the process kind of like kick it off. Because, you know, I don't know very many developers who've got a spare $3,500 either. So they can start working on products.
I mean, these things start slow. The Oculus was big and bulky and you were tethered to a computer and it was also very expensive. And yeah. Now like Quest 2s are commodities.
So I think there's a couple of things Apple, I think, is doing wrong on this. One is, yes, they need to figure out how to embrace the developer more in the process. So even if they gave away 1,000 units to, you know, known publishers of apps that are popular on the Apple Store, they could go a long way in building content for these things. But Apple has really alienated a lot of developers in the last few years. You know, especially with App Store percentages they're taking in sales, the way they, you know, treat them is not very nice lately. So, you know, it's a tough community for Apple to break into right now. And then I think the killer apps that I've heard is really the video experiences. Like there's an Alicia Keys concert where they put you basically into the scene with her in different angles. You can move around and see her in all the dimensions. You know, that stuff has to be created. That's not something you can just generate. And so, you know, you need to sign deals with artists and video create these things. And that takes quite a bit of work and time. But it's interesting. I was listening to another podcast that I listened to and, you know, he has a Vision Pro. Can't keep the name straight. And he actually just went to the Sphere in Vegas and he was commenting about how the Sphere experience is basically like what the Vision Pro is going for, but in real life without the headset. the huge, you know, screen, and I've been to the Sphere as well. I did the movie. I haven't done a concert there yet, but I did the movie. And it is, you know, larger than life. The sound is incredible. Like you definitely feel like you're looking out a window at this scene they built out, and you know, the audio sounds like it's right next to your head and the bases and the seats and everything. It's an amazing experience there. And how do you replicate that in a headset is kind of hard to do, but it's very interesting.
Yeah, I think that the thing that the Vision Pro has got going for it that other VR systems don't though is augmented reality is one thing, but it's eye tracking. Mm-hmm. Because as soon as you can do eye tracking, you can start doing like dynamic focusing, because using an Oculus Rift for a few hours at a time, it sucks because your eyes have to focus at, you know, 3 meters ahead of you or something constantly. And you can't turn your gaze to look at something, you know, the game or whatever. The content has to put what it wants you to see in focus, and that's how it guides your gaze in a way. But with the Vision Pro, you can actually track people's eyes and you can bring into focus the things they're looking at, and that's going to completely change the experience. So I'm kind of disappointed. It's as expensive as it is, and I hope somebody else comes out with a cheaper version.
Well, I mean, I hear the Apple plans to eventually release a cheaper version of it, unless they kill it before then. But, you know, Tim Cook in general needs to find a growth product for Apple, because iPhone sales are sluggish. You know, Macs with these new M series Macs, they don't really need to buy a new one once you have an M. Like my M1 MacBook is my personal one. Like, I have no need to replace that one anytime soon. And then I did just upgrade my iPad because they moved to OLED screens and I really wanted an OLED iPad. But you know, it's, you know, the compelling reasons to upgrade is not CPU or battery anymore, because those are all replaceable, or so overpowered in these devices, you just don't need more. And then they killed the car. So I mean, like, just in general, they had to figure out how to grow, because the market's going to start killing their pretty high valuation if they don't come up with something.
I kind of wonder if stuff will like go full circle again, and people will want more dedicated devices to avoid the distractions. Because the problem with the phone is you go and try and do one thing and a notification pops up and you get distracted and you go off and do something else, and eventually you remember what you were there for. But like the iPod, I'm surprised they killed the iPod.
I mean, they kept it going for a long time before they killed it. Yeah. So I would think a new iPod would not sell. I just don't see it.
I would still like, I always loved my little iPod Shuffle with the clip. Mm-hmm. I always loved that one. It was so tiny, did one thing and that's it. And sometimes I sound like an old man yelling at cloud. I understand.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can stream music, Bluetooth music from an Apple Watch to headphones, so you don't need to carry the phone around. I was just trying to get away from having to carry the phone in certain situations.
There's been some new devices that have come out, some recent AI stuff. Like there was a pin you could wear that would basically, give you a small laser projector, and so you could use it for some AI use cases. And
it was a disaster,
not good. And there's another one that, records audio basically, and then sends you summaries of all the audio that you heard during the day. So you like a real time note person with you all the time. So like there's definitely people trying new ideas. Nothing's hit yet.
Yeah, in a way, I think like the Google Glass was 10 years too soon. How long is it now? It's probably 10 years ish.
At least, yeah.
I mean, imagine with today's compute and the things that AI can do, what you could do today with Google Glass.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and like they actually, Ray-Ban Meta smart glasses have cameras built into them, much smaller form factor, not as powerful as what the Google Glass could do, but, it is sort of coming back in some ways now that the form factors are smaller.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of articles from a quick search about glasses coming, being the comeback with Ray-Ban and everything today from the Google conference out at Google I.O. Yeah. Project Astra. Don't know enough about it.
Well, we started one place and we ended up about five other topics, so that was good.
Yeah.
That's kind of the point of the after show, I feel like. Yeah. Let's meander around. This is the way our brains work.
Exactly. All right, guys. See you next week.
Yep. See you later.
All right. Bye now.